This is Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader. I've been doing a lot of soccer broadcasting in this space, chatting with announcers, producers, directors, executives about the business in 2024, learning a lot, talking with plenty of interesting people about what they do and how they do it. I have a particular interest in this. I broadcast Major League Soccer for more than 15 years on radio and on television. Really, one of my favorite jobs in a long sports broadcasting career. In this episode, I chat with 31-year-old South Florida native Chris Whittingham. He does MLS games on Apple TV+, and among his other jobs, a gig doing Serie A games on Paramount Plus and CBS. A soccer broadcaster from the new generation of soccer broadcasters who've learned the business in a studio in front of a TV monitor.
For me, I actually probably have the opposite growth pattern from most broadcasters, which is you start in stadiums and then you have to figure out your way to cope with calling games off monitor. But realistically, I didn't call... Once I left college, I went to the University of Miami and called obviously a lot of events in person. But my first professional gigs were with CONCACAF and BN. Everything there was off monitor. Then I went to Vista. Everything there was off monitor. I think I called my first NASL game either in 2015 or in 2016. For the next 4 years, working at Univision as well, I didn't work an event in person. And so I actually became more familiar with doing games off monitor. And then the adjustment was in 2020 when I started to work for Inter Miami. And this was obviously during COVID and there was nobody in the stadiums, but I was actually calling games from the stadium. So the adjustment was probably the flip of what you probably experience in most broadcasters.
So you didn't call anything in person in the stadium between about 2016 and 2020? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Wow. Yes. I called the NASL for BN, the USL for Vista, CONCACAF for Vista, Liga MX and MLS for Univision. I worked a few events for DAZN. I worked a few South American continental tournaments, Libertadores and Sudamericana. I worked all these events and they were all off tube, all of them. So I probably went the first 4 or 5 years without ever being in a stadium. And Inter Miami, I think their first home game back from the MLS's back tournament was against Orlando at Drive Pink Stadium, probably like in July of 2020. And that was the first time I had called a soccer match in which the participants were in front of me and not on a screen.
Vista is Vista WorldLink, a production house where many of these young broadcasters work in front of the television monitor. Whittingham is from a multicultural, multilingual family. Well, he was raised in Florida. His mother was born in Colombia. His father was born in Los Angeles to Colombian-born parents. I'm going to assume that you do the games in Spanish on Univision.
Right? No, I never worked in Spanish for Univision. Hired me to be an English language broadcaster because they were doing MLS on SAP back in the day, and then the broadcast would be streaming on some kind of platform. It used to be Facebook, and then was eventually Twitter. So they would do the English broadcasts for that. And then in 2019, they hired me because they're going to start doing all of their Liga MX broadcasts in English because they had the rights and they weren't doing anything with them. And so I was doing like 4 or 5 Liga MX broadcasts in English a weekend. Just like, you know, Friday night, Saturday, 6 p.m., Saturday, 10 p.m., Sunday afternoon, sometimes Sunday evening, like yeah. Copa midweek. Like it was just everything they had that was Mexican football in English.
You do speak Spanish, though.
Yes, probably not at a broadcastable level, but yes, I do speak Spanish.
Born 3 days after the devastating Hurricane Andrew in August of 1992, Chris Whittingham, at a relatively young age, is heading to the top of the soccer broadcasting business. I chatted with Chris while he was in a break before he was about to broadcast a Serie A game for Paramount Plus in their Connecticut studios.
the Sierra games are all in Connecticut. They've done a few, and they'll like publicize, hey, we're in San Siro this week, or we're in Napoli. But I would say it's probably been less than 10 times that they've done that. So for the most part, I call the games in Connecticut, yeah.
So you fly up there. How often do you do those games?
So believe it or not, they actually also have a studio in Fort Lauderdale, and they've been getting me set up there sometimes as well. I've done some games from there. I've done some games up here when I come up here to do the shows. So, yeah.
How did you get into the soccer broadcasting business? Where's the genesis of that?
Yeah, so I don't want to say it was an accident, but it kind of was. I went to the University of Miami with every intention of getting into, quote, American sports. The NFL, or the American footballs and the basketballs and the baseballs and all that stuff. And I love the NFL growing up, but I'm Colombian by sort of origin. My parents, my mom was born there. My dad was born in LA to Colombian parents. So I'm fully Colombian. And as a result, like when World Cups came around and all that stuff, football was obviously a big part of my growing up. But I like the, quote, American sports better. And honestly, a large part of it is to do with living in South Florida, just because, strangely, there are a lot of places down in South Florida that produce soccer. And so I got a call one day that CONCACAF were starting a project and they were going to redo old CONCACAF competitions, Champions League, Gold Cups and all that. They're going to produce a bunch of packages on some of the other countries. I remember doing a piece on Curacao and their revolution with all the Dutch expats that were coming and were going to, turn football in Curacao. And that actually was a useful experience because they were in a Gold Cup like 6 years later. And it was like kind of worthwhile to have learned that in 2015. So I got a call to work on this. And then from there, one of the producers started working at BN Sports, which is also based in South Florida. And then he asked me to do the NASL for them. So they were at the time the owners of Serie A and Ligue 1 and obviously La Liga, and they wanted to keep it going into the evening, and so they brought in the NASL, and they needed another broadcaster for that. So they asked me if I can do it, and so I started doing that. And honestly, from there, like obviously I was still open to doing other, quote, American sports, but all the opportunities were in soccer, and so I just kept going and going and going, and here I am still working in soccer.
And most of what you did early on in your career was done in front of a television monitor. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. From that job at CONCACAF all the way through to probably 2023, I was working largely games off monitor. And you still do, right? I do Serie A for CBS. We're obviously not in Italy every week. So I'm still pretty familiar with doing that.
So when did that start then? How many years are we talking about where you do absolutely everything on the monitor and then finally, oh, they actually invite people into these games and I get to see them in person?
Well, the funny thing is that the first time I started doing games in person, there was nobody invited other than the broadcasters because it was COVID. And so it was, July of 2020, and I had been asked to do some Inter-Miami radio broadcasts, and then from MLS's back, and then all of a sudden we were back in stadiums on that regional basis. There are no fans in the ground, but I was there, and I remember, there was nobody in the crowd, but I got to see all the players, and I got to see, what corners look like, not in the replay angle and all this stuff. But yeah, from 2015, when I started doing that work for CONCACAF all the way through, and that's at obviously CONCACAF, BN Sports. I did a few games for DAZN. I did some work for Univision, both on a part-time and full-time basis, doing MLS and Liga MX. And I'm probably forgetting some too. Oh, Vista, working for the USL Championship, then just the USL at the time. They had CONCACAF. I did some NWSL for them. All these leagues, right? I'm working on all this soccer. All of it's off monitor. And so I actually probably have the reverse experience of most broadcasters, where you get used to being in the stadium, and then you have to adjust once you're in person, or once you're on monitor and you can't see everything. For me, it was the opposite. It was almost like I had been exposed, like it was going from black and white to color. And I almost didn't know what to do once I got in the stadium. And I actually, I probably would regret some of those first broadcasts because I might've had a little bit too much energy and I might've been over describing or over talking because, wow, I could see everything. And it was an adjustment the other way, just as I imagine for most broadcasters, it is the opposite adjustment going to calling games off monitor.
So you're talking about, as we say in the business, right? You can see it, you can feel it, you can touch it. You know, that's what you want to do, and you want to portray that for the audience. How did you try to see it, touch it, feel it for the audience when you're sitting in a little television studio in front of a monitor?
And honestly, it felt pretty normal to me. I mean, obviously, people would ask you, right? It's like, yeah, you know, I'd obviously rather be there, but you crank up the gnats for, you know, that's obviously very jargon, but the feed of the crowd and the kicking of the ball and the noises of the game, and you have on your board in front of you the ability to turn that up. So you just turn it up and you kind of transport yourself to a world where you felt like you were there, and you enter this zone where the game is the only thing going on and it's the focus of your attention, and you kind of feel like you're there even though you're not. So I think I always, and again, it's a good lesson to learn as well, because I think people have the opposite problem, which is you go from being in stadiums, the stadiums create the atmosphere for you, and so you are kind of a little bit more tempered so that you're not going above and beyond what it is. And then once you get in the studio and it's antiseptic and it's anodyne, you go, well, I can't really, I have to summon a new level of energy. I always kind of did the opposite, and I had to figure out ways to tone myself down once I was in stadiums and once I was calling games on TV in stadiums. But it was kind of a valuable experience in, it's not always going to be a brilliant atmosphere. It's not always going to be the most environmental. It's not always going to be this thing that gives you energy. You sometimes have to bring the energy to the game, because the people that are watching it don't care that you're not there. They don't care that it's less than doing a Champions League final or a World Cup final in person. They still care about their team and their game, and they want you to bring it. And so I think it was kind of a valuable lesson in that.
They tuned in to see that game, right? If there's 20 of them or 20,000 of them or 2 million of them, they tuned in to see that very game, and you have to give that to them. That's it.
Or even like in the instance of, let's say, doing the NASL, right? Part of the reason why you do a broadcast deal with somebody is somebody's left their TV on since the, you know, Barcelona game in the afternoon, and they're watching the studio programming, up pops this game, and you're kind of doing, not that like I thought of my job this way, but you're doing marketing for the league that you're broadcasting for. You want to give that league the best shot of earning some new viewers and finding some new fans, because somebody just happened to leave their TV on, and you don't want to sound bored and uninterested so that the people that are watching are also bored and uninterested.
How many games do you suppose you've done in front of a TV monitor?
Hundreds. I would probably say, it feels like slightly exaggerating to say this, but probably around 1,000, I'd guess.
And have you been able to analyze about how it made you a better broadcaster? How did doing all of that work make you a better broadcaster and prepare you for the place you're in now at a pretty young age?
I think it allows you to do a game without the full amount of information that you need, right? So for instance, for me, the biggest thing going from off tube to in stadium was getting to see referees, because sometimes the director of the game doesn't show big decisions, handing out yellows. We're in replays, we're showing, you know, let's say there's two players fighting off the ball. That is more compelling television than the referee going to his pocket, grabbing a card and showing a card. And so you will miss things, or you'll be in replays, you don't see the formations for corners or like little things like that, or you won't see when the offside flag goes up. I remember that was another huge one for me. Wow, I can see the offside flag. And you don't have to kind of do that guessing game, particularly now in the VAR era, where a player can run in behind, go and finish a goal. Everyone knows it's offside, but the flag, the assistant's going to keep their flag down to allow the play to continue. And just in case it's onside, they can check it on VAR. So you have this incomplete picture of the game. And so you know how to adjust your language. You know, you're a little bit more conservative in terms of either going for it or not going for it, because you don't want to guess and be wrong. And I think that's the best thing that I've learned, is that it obviously is really damaging to be wrong when you say something. And so you're very careful, you're very deliberate. And because you don't have the full information, because you're not there in person, you're much more deliberate with what you say, because that's the only way you can, because you don't have a complete picture of everything.
Sometimes the challenge is waiting for that moment when you make sure you know who scored the goal, because when you have that view, you can't call the goal scorer until you know who the goal scorer is,
right?
Until somebody in that production shows you the goal scorer.
And sometimes
you
kind of learn how to piece it together, because who's given it the biggest celebration, right? That's usually the person who put it away. It would be pretty weird if someone other than the goal scorer was given it the biggin', as it were. But yeah, look, like, that's definitely a huge part of it. I also think it has definitely sharpened my player ID abilities. Mm-hmm. I think being able to know who a player is based off the color of their boots, based off the style of their hair, based off of, you know, how this person's frame is different to that person's frame. And I would expect you do work on player identification, I think, a little bit more than you even would, because when you're in person, you can kind of see it more clearly. But you watch a few games of the team, their previous games, and you would expect, okay, yeah, that person's a left back, but sometimes he'll pop up in this spot, and sometimes he'll pop up in that spot. Like, I do a fair bit of Napoli, just because, you know, they're one of the big Serie A teams, and their right back, Giovanni Di Lorenzo, he's everywhere. And so you kind of have to expect that he's going to be anywhere in attacking sequence. Sometimes it still kind of catches me off guard, but having done a few Napoli games, I know to expect the unexpected with him, and those are things that I'm not certain you would take too much of a keen interest on unless you had a more difficult job of player identification on. And so it has definitely sharpened my abilities. I would say it's one of my best traits as a broadcaster, is being able to pick out from a corner when 16 players are in the penalty area which one of them got the touch to get it away, or just little things like that. Mm-hmm. And that might seem like a pretty basic skill, but it's definitely one that's important to me, and one that I feel that I've definitely sharpened because of the number of games I've called off TV.
This will help me explain to my students, because they listen to what I have to say and then they hear it from somebody else and they go, oh yeah, I get it. It's that you don't really call the game based on the number on their back. You call it on their body and their spacing and their hair, the color of their boots, right? Basketball is the same way, right? It says time and space game. You don't call the game. In football, you do by number, but still, you basically do it by who they are, where they are, what the play is. Mm-hmm. So this is a good lesson for young people to understand that those are the things you have to look out for. You know, because you're not always going to see the number. You don't always get to see the number.
No, and for me, I would sort of call it the first line of defense, the number. Like, if you see the number, it's great, because that means you've got it. But in some ways, I think doing it another way allows you to kind of go beyond that and realize that you don't just need to memorize a player's number against their name. You have to almost in some ways come to learn who they are in every way, right? The way that they play, their, as you said, their physicality, their the color of shoes that they wear, and all of the different identifying traits. And you instead come up with this picture of a player where you know who they are. You know what Fafa Picot of then Nashville, now Vancouver Whitecaps, is as a player. And so when he pops up in an area that's different where you might expect him to, I now know, all right, that's Fafa. I know who that is. And I think that's a slightly different thing than having memorized something. You know who they are, and I feel like I'm better with that. Even with new players that come into the league, it doesn't take me very long to register who they are. And I feel like that's just a skill that you learn because you have a little bit more difficult of a challenge. There was two NASL teams in particular that didn't broadcast their games in full 1080p quality. It was like 720 on a good day. And like, you couldn't see the numbers. You couldn't. And so you had to figure out other ways. I remember literally watching a replay of one of their games and like just shouting out their names. So-and-so, so-and-so. And every time I would just watch the game for 10 minutes, just not doing anything other than trying to remember who that player is. And so, yeah, those are things you have to learn when you're in less than ideal circumstances.
I will tell you how old I am, is that that's how we used to call games way back when we didn't have Huddle for high school. We didn't have videotape for every games. Not many teams were broadcast. So you do a college basketball game, you've never seen the team play. So you spend the first 5 or 10 minutes of the game just figuring out who the players are. That's a good note. Thankfully, we do have video and we do have things available.
Websites with basic information.
Yay. Yeah, and how to pronounce their names. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah.
As you look at it now, how grateful are you that you learned how to broadcast soccer on the TV monitor and putting it into what you do now?
I am very grateful because I think I did it in the right order. You do games of, I get you could say lesser importance, but again, to those people, it's not lesser importance. You go from, you know, and it's not the worst circumstances. They're good, you know, facilities and everything works technically and it's a good place to learn your craft, but you go from being, you know, calling a game where there's 1,000 people in the crowd and you're calling it off monitor to being in the stadium. I did a few games last year in NFL stadiums where there was 60,000 people in Atlanta. There was 50,000 people in Santa Clara for a San Jose Earthquakes game. There's, you know, these big atmospheres and you're walking through the stadium and every bit of the facility is first class and you have this whole catering and you have this production crew that's working with you. In some ways, I almost have like imposter syndrome when I work in environments like that because I've spent so much time in a commentary booth in a warehouse in Dania Beach, Florida, calling a game off a monitor. Like that's just how my broadcast. So in some ways, I think I did things in the right order. Whereas if I started off in some big environment and feeling like, wow, this is really high level. And then you have to work your way down. In some ways, I think you develop habits that maybe don't help you in those situations. And it's just a reality of modern television. Like, let's be real, not just in soccer, but in all sports mm-hmm. where you have to call games off monitor. Now they send you equipment to call games from home. That's just a thing. And so I think to have built those skills, to have done it in the right order, to, like I said, place an importance on a game where you go, ah, who cares, right? Like people would say that all the time. And again, if it's 20 people, if it's 200 people, there's more than one person that cares. Even if they're gamblers, it doesn't matter to me. Like they care about the game. They care about the outcome of the game. Yeah. They want to learn a little bit from you and they want you to show interest. And so when you do CONCACAF Nations League C, and it's being played at a cricket stadium and there's, you know, 20 people in the crowd, you have to still give it your same energy, your same level of prep. And so I think having gone from there to calling games in Syria where there's 90,000 people in San Siro and it's the greatest atmosphere you've ever seen, I think gives you a sense of perspective that every game is worth the work. Every game is worth your undivided attention. And you have to give your same amount of energy to the big games as the quote small ones because they matter to somebody.
And let's be honest, you wouldn't have had 1,000 games. If you were doing games in the stadium, you wouldn't get 150, 200 games a year.
Correct. Absolutely. No, and you come across so many things. In some ways, it's that level of experience where things don't really catch you off guard anymore. I remember the first time in a game where, and it's probably only happened to me twice in all those games, where there was an indirect free kick given. And I remember I was so fortunate because like 3 weeks earlier, I had seen a game in which an indirect free kick was given. And I'm not sure most people know that particular law of the game where mm-hmm. if it's a back pass and the goalkeeper grabs it with his hands or for whatever reason an indirect free kick is given, to know what happens, to know the procedure, to know that there's gonna be a free kick taken from 4 yards off the goal line and they're gonna stack 10 players in the goal. Like, and so I'm fortunate to have seen a lot of things happen and a lot of different scenarios. I remember working I worked a show for CBS for the Europa League, and there was a situation in which a free kick taker hits the ball off the crossbar, hits the crossbar so hard, the ball comes back to them, and that's an illegal touch. Everything that happens after that is disallowed because you cannot play the ball off the woodwork from a direct free kick. That's why when you see penalties taken, when they hit the woodwork, you're not allowed to touch it the second time. And so the more games you call, the more different things that you do, yeah, the more likely you are to come across all these scenarios, and so they don't catch you off guard anymore. And so, yeah, that experience of just having done game after game after game after game presents you with all these different things, and you know what you're going to say in certain moments.
Chris Winningham broadcasts soccer on a number of channels or for a number of outlets, primarily MLS Season Pass on Apple TV Plus and Serie A games on Paramount Plus and CBS. I'm John Schrader. This is Watch the Media. Do you think, Chris, that you are in the first generation of soccer announcers who really can make a living out of this? Generations before, mm-hmm. I mean, I did two or three other jobs and did soccer. And I think you are in a generation, are you not, where you can really believe this is a career?
Yes, I do. And I'm grateful for that because obviously a lot of people have put the work into this in order to make this possible. The game has grown immeasurably in the last 15 years to make this happen. So yeah, I do. I also think that, again, a lot of kids grow up in the United States liking other sports, and maybe their broadcasting career aspirations are in other sports, and you get presented with the opportunity to do soccer. And I know that I just said that about myself, but probably by the time I was 22, I kind of realized I really like working in soccer. I'd be fine if this is all I did for the rest of my life. And I think that because of the accessibility of soccer on TV and now streaming and on social media as well, I think younger people have that sense of that this is aspirational. This is what I want to be doing in a way that maybe other people, like you said, you have to work other jobs or, you know, this is kind of something that you came across, but you ended up liking it. I think there are people that really want to work in the sport, that love this sport. And it's really cool to work for the CBS Golazo Network because it's kind of an environment where that's almost the first cultural norm that they've set. We all love the game here. We all want to be doing this. This is something that we're really proud of. And I think that's great for a lot of people that they can form their careers that way because that wasn't always the case. There, you always had to be in older newsrooms, whether in local TV or on ESPN or whatever. You had to be fighting for the airtime. You had to be fighting for, hey, this soccer thing deserves your attention. Whereas now there is an ecosystem of business, which is obviously like the way that you really get anything done in this country, is you make it make business sense. But also a group of people that are executives that are forming these ideas that like the game, that want to grow the game, that realize that it has an audience. And so I think I've entered a different environment than somebody entering the business would have 20 years ago or 30 years ago, because there are all these opportunities to make a living, to work in places that value soccer and want to grow the game.
A lot of us who watch this look at CBS Golazo and say, wow, we're getting some fresh, we're getting something new, we're getting something innovative. Is that how you look at it? Is that sort of the cultural environment they're trying to create here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the thing that they value the most. I think the idea of being on all the time, I think, is really valuable to them, and they want to show off the fact that they have an operation that starts in the morning with Morning Footy at 8 a.m. that will show you the Asian Cup, that'll show you Serie A, that'll have live matches on, but also is basically your one-stop shop to know the things you need to know throughout the day. And I'm really impressed at the breadth as well. Like, for instance, you get news of an MLS signing, and you go to the producer and be like, hey, this player signed for an MLS club. Should we do this? Yeah, let's do a news story on that. We'll get a reaction from somebody or whatever. Like, they want to cover everything, not just Manchester United, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, the big European teams, or the U.S. men's national team, or the World Cup. They want to cover everything. And so I think it is becoming that one resource for fans to get to know everything about the game in an hour show, in a two-hour show, with video, with highlights and all that stuff. So I think they kind of realized that there was this market there for people who are sitting around, want to have something on in the background, or want to catch up on what happened during the day, and you can get it in bite-sized information.
They're also a really good example, I think. You just say, all right, CBS. Well, ESPN, Disney was in the soccer business for a long time. Fox has been in the soccer business for a long time. NBC now for quite a while. CBS. It basically says these major American corporations realize that there is a future business, as you say, right? There's good business in this. And I think CBS jumping in, not just that they got in and they're in the you know, the kiddie pool and they're waiting in the kiddie pool, they jumped in the deep end of the pool in this. And I think that's a good example of the business interest of soccer in this country, right?
Yeah, and I think it's the recognition that there is value in the soccer consumer. That for years, soccer fans have been asked to go to this service and that service and this service and that service to watch your games. And so since you have this highly informed audience of very passionate fans, there are people who will subscribe to Paramount Plus to watch the Champions League. Whereas you see even what happened with the NFL, you put one game, one playoff game on a streaming service and it's the end of the universe. Whereas I think soccer fans have kind of been used to doing that. And so, yeah, we'll go. And yeah, you make your choices and now it's becoming a little bit more expensive and you have to make your choices about what you want to watch. But it's all available And people will, if you put on a good product, and CBS, I think the first thing that they decided to do is, let's make our Champions League coverage big on the level of our NFL studio coverage. And the success they had with that champ, or they're having with that Champions League Today show, is unbelievable. You looked at the social media metrics on the clips of Thierry and Micah and Jamie and Kate. They're unbelievable. And so you build kind of your brand that way. Again, these are business terms that I'm sure, you know, purist soccer fans don't love, but there has to be an underpinning business model. Once the Fox Soccer business model didn't work anymore, the channel goes away. Once the BN Sports model, obviously we've seen them fade. There has to be an underlying business model of selling subscriptions, of... Now, obviously, the fast channel world is developing, and for those that don't know, that's a very kind of industry jargon word, but it's basically these advertiser-supported free streaming channels that are all over Roku TV and Pluto TV, and they come with your Samsung TV, and I have an LG. I've got a whole list of channels that I can... What are these? They're basically programming that's on that, obviously, a lot of... companies can make money off selling ads against and all that stuff. So you see all these different things, and I think... Hold on one second. I think I might have accidentally turned on my TV by talking. My TV is voice activated, so I might have turned it on by accident by giving that answer. I said the LG TV, and all of a sudden it wanted to start feeding me channels.
It's a smart TV. It's
very smart.
It's the Alexa.
So I think that model, like CBS has had a lot of success with it. With CBS HQ was the first one. CBS News they have on the news side, and so they're like, what if we did that for soccer? And that's how Golazo Network started. So. Again, it's just that ability to recognize the business models that work for streaming companies. And it's also a way to prove your technology and all these different things. So soccer has to have business value in order to continue to grow. And ever more so, it grows.
Speaking of streaming services, last winter, December, January, MLS, Apple TV Plus, the MLS season pass is a thing. Every announcer who's done soccer in America is waiting for the phone call. Everybody gets an interview. Everybody thinks that they're going to be the person who gets that. A number of people, of course, were sorely disappointed they didn't get that call, but you did. What was your reaction when they said, hey, come join this new venture?
Can I actually tell you that at one point I got a call that I wasn't in?
Really?
like 3 weeks before I got the call that I was in, I got a call that I was out. I was pretty fortunate in the end to have eventually gotten through the door. I thank obviously everyone at MLS I honestly have no idea. I got a call that, hey, you know, we'll keep an eye on you. And, obviously we really liked you and all that, but right now there isn't an opportunity. And I mean, I honestly, I don't want to speculate. I don't know what changed.
Don't ask.
But all I know,
don't answer.
Exactly. So I was very fortunate that eventually I did, and it was incredible. And like you said, I know there are a lot of people that are disappointed that they didn't get that call. But the reality is that there's only a certain number of jobs, and there's 14 games in a weekend, and they need 14 crews, and in the end, they probably needed a few more, and they did find a few more, but. That like there was a limited number of opportunities, and I'm really grateful that I was able to get one of them. And honestly, it was by far the best year that I've had in broadcasting, because like I told you earlier, I wasn't in stadiums before. I've not traveled the country doing sports, which is such a typical experience if you're a sports broadcaster or you work in the industry at all, is you go travel around the country. But right. Because I was calling all these games off tube, I never went anywhere. And so to go to and it's not just go to the places, it's absorb the soccer cultures of all these different places. Right. Was amazing to go to Ohio and see the cathedrals that they built in Cincinnati and Columbus, and Austin's a great place, and everywhere. I loved going absolutely everywhere in the country, even going to Dallas, where I remember watching Dallas 8-9 years ago, and you'd watch a game and the stadium was kind of half full and it didn't seem like there was a lot of energy. There's enormous energy around FC Dallas. Even before Messi showed up for Leagues Cup and they got that first game there, they were selling out a bunch of games. I think statistically a big increase in sellouts in MLS last year. I think part of that was the regular schedule playing every Saturday night at 7:30. That's the best time to get fans through the door. And so I think there was that genuine feeling of I'm absorbing the culture of our country in soccer. I absolutely loved it.
So how many games did you do, and who did you do most of the games with?
So my main partner was Lori Lindsay. I think we're going to keep working together, and she's wonderful. I ended up doing 38 38, I want to say. I kept track of it. I can open up a Google Doc if you want. But it was something around 38, 39 that I ended up doing over the course of the season.
So Lori had some very nice things to say about you. She really enjoys working with you. And she had a wonderful time. And so tell me what worked. Because chemistry is a really interesting ethereal thing in our business.
Yes.
And it doesn't always work. And the audience kind of knows it when it doesn't work. So how do you make it work?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, and again, that's also part of the experience of having worked at all these places I've worked at, is I worked with a ton of different people. And I think you have to realize that there is the moment for you, but particularly in the case of doing TV sports, for me, it's the analyst medium. And so you have to afford the space to provide the analyst the chance for them to shine. And I think Lori and I, by the end of the year, did a great job of recognizing when was my time and when was her time. And I always tried to lay out, and I can still afford to do a better job being like, Lori, what do you think? Lori, what do you think? And trying to set up at the beginning of the game, her big thought, the big thing that she's looking out for. But I think we do a really good job of, number one, just talking about the game a lot. I think that's kind of the biggest thing, is we would meet up, before a game in Orlando, and let's go around for tacos or something, and we're sitting around, we're having dinner, and we're just talking about soccer, not even necessarily the game that we're covering. We're just talking about the game and all that stuff, and she has so much to share in terms of her playing experience and her life experience as well, working in the game. She does a bit of work for U.S. Soccer that's fascinating, Yeah, we just ended up sharing so much about the way that we view the game and all that stuff. And a lot of it is actually fairly similar, which is kind of helpful, right? Because sometimes you work with people that maybe they have a different view of the game to you, or they value different things and you're kind of trying to adjust, or they reject certain ideas. You bring up XG and, what's XG? Explain that to me. Why is that important? Oh, what a useless stat. And I think when you work with someone that has a little bit more of a modern view like Lori does, and wants to, information, that's great. I want to learn more. Let me soak in as much as I can. And I think we just help each other so much. And honestly, a lot of it just comes down to personality. She's a lovely person. And she's honestly one of just the nicest people that I've ever met. We just love hanging out. We have so many inside jokes. We're in a group chat together. And I can't wait to work with her again. And I think we're actually going to end up working on things beyond just MLS together. So it's great. I love working with her. And but also, to be fair, last year, just because of the nature, I think because I was one of the last people through the door, it was initial. I remember when it was announced, it was Lori's working some with Jen Hildreth and some with me. And so I ended up working with Danielle Slayton out in the Bay Area, who's also lovely and fantastic. But also throughout the year, it was, all right, we're going to put you here, we're going to put you here, we're going to put you here. I think over the course of the year, I worked with 8 or 9 different analysts last year. It just, Lori was the one I predominantly worked with. And then once it came time for the playoffs, that was the pairing. But I ended up working with a ton of different people, all of whom were amazing. I think part of that is, I think I just have a natural predisposition to want to get along with people and accent their abilities as broadcasters as well as my own. And I think it's also a great job by the people at MLS who put this all together, that they found a bunch of like-minded, passionate, good broadcasters that can all work together in any combination. It's just some might work better together than others.
So who do you expect to work with? Who are you starting out this season?
Lori. Okay. With Lori.
There you go. You mentioned Jen Hildreth and Lori Lindsay and Danielle Slayton, and not to make this sound like it's about, equal opportunity here, because we know women still don't have the same kinds of opportunities to work in our business as men do. But it is impressive in soccer, not just in MLS, but in soccer, World Cup pairings, women with women, that this is a space where the people who run it are really trying to get a real mixture, not just women, but a real diverse group of people with experiences and backgrounds that make it richer. I mean, you say your family's Colombian, right? It's just people from different kinds of backgrounds make it such a richer experience for everybody. And I'm not pandering to MLS. I don't have any skin in the game. I'm not pandering, but they're trying really hard to make the broadcast kind of look like who we are. You think that?
Correct. Absolutely. And I think it's really important, having worked at a few different places, even talking to people behind the scenes, I think it's really important for people to have connections with the things that they're seeing on screen, with the content that they consume. And so you have to reach out to, especially when you're trying to sell subscriptions, you want to reach out to a wide variety of audience. You're not just selling your subscriptions to white men or white women or black men or black women. You're trying to sell subscriptions to everybody. And so you have to have a genuine representation of everyone. And also, it's in some ways that is a part of the math. But for me, when I work with Lori, I don't think I'm working with a woman. I think I'm working with an analyst who knows way more about the game than I ever will, right? And I think that's the biggest thing. I also want to transmit that to the audience, that she played, that she sees the game in a different way than I do. And when we are calling the game together, we're looking at different things because of our experiences. And so I think that's the biggest thing for me, is just learning that ability to, you know, work with anyone. And it doesn't really require much learning, because everyone brings something great. And that's the biggest thing, is that it's not for the sake of anything other than, when you bring in a variety of perspectives, you get a variety of perspectives. And I think that's the biggest thing that everyone can afford to learn, is that your own perspective about soccer, about anything in this world, is different than somebody else's. And it's important and useful to learn them from other people than it is to learn them from you. Because Lori will say to me all the time, the difference is between the things that she experienced in her career and the things that we see week in, week out covering MLS, and how she tries to square those differences and is learning culturally about the men's game and learning about MLS and the way that it works compared to the things that happen in her experience. And so squaring those differences is really interesting. And there are a lot of things that are really interesting that we can learn from anybody who has a different background of the game.
MLS will tell you that their audience is more diverse, that it's a bit younger, that it's a bit better educated. I don't know, my words are like hipper and fresher, maybe. How does that form how the presentation of the games are made?
I think Apple are making a considerable effort to realize, and I believe the figures in the end ended up being something like 10 years on average younger their audience, and even what MLS was on terrestrial TV, that they ran the numbers and they realized that their streaming audience is even younger. So they do want to present the game. You know, if you watch their baseball broadcast, there are tons of data on the screen and analytics and all that stuff. I think that's definitely a part of it. But I also think just in the presentation of, you're putting the games in the hands of producers that, again, love the game, that want to work on the game, that want to present it in the way that is authentic to them, broadcasters and people on camera that are younger, that genuinely feel the game, that know the game in that way. And I don't think necessarily there has to be anything deliberate about what you do after that. It is just a representation of who these people are and the work that they do. And yes, there are some traditions or some things about calling a game that, you know, I watch Martin Tyler on TV. He's in his 70s. He's a British man. I don't actually like have much of a way of a cultural connection to him, but I've watched so many games that there are probably things that I say that I've borrowed from elderly British men, which doesn't really make any sense, but also is, when you consume the game, like, you're encountering these unbelievably talented broadcasters and wordsmiths that have affected your language in the way that you talk about the game. So I think it's just a manifestation of the people that they brought in. And you make those choices about the way that you're presenting your coverage based off the people that you choose to bring in and the way that they will represent you. Because I think that's the biggest thing, is in the end, it is a representation of who all these people are that is most like the audience that you're trying to serve.
Apple is very proud to tell you that if you have an Apple subscription, that you can watch these broadcasts, whether you're in Bangkok or Buenos Aires or Beijing. And so that isn't really part of the question. The question is, what do you think the rest of the world now thinks about American soccer that they can see on television?
I think people that tune in would probably be pleasantly surprised that almost no matter where you tune into a game from, there's a good crowd, there's a good atmosphere, there's a good broadcast on, and there are good players on display. And Yes, any soccer league has boring games. Any soccer league has games that are less forget or more forgettable than others, but also obviously better than others. But I think genuinely the level that you see week in, week out probably surprises a lot of people. And obviously a lot of people would have tuned in with Messi. And I think the biggest thing that happened once Messi joined the league is I think a lot of people stepped up to present something that's even bigger than what we were doing before. And what we were doing was plenty big. To scale 14 broadcasts a week with basically an entirely new infrastructure, it's not a sports network that's existed for years and they know how to put on games. This whole thing came together pretty quickly amongst entities that had never done something like this before. And voila, we put a very good product on the air. And then once Messi comes, you got to take it that step further. You're putting sky cams over the stadiums and you're showing celebrities in the crowd and you're doing all these different things that you weren't doing before. So I think what it did was provide that accessibility to anyone in the world who wanted to watch an MLS game, they can. And I think people that have rooting interests in their countries because certain players play here or whatever must have been pleasantly surprised with the quality of coverage both in English and in Spanish because the Spanish team do a fantastic job as well. There's 14 great announced pairings every weekend in both languages, some in French too. The French guys were fantastic last year as well. And there are a bunch of dedicated people that put a good product on the air. And I think that's the biggest thing is you have to make the product on the level of the products that you usually consume. And if we are far away at all, I don't think we're very far away from putting on a product of that level.
What do you think will be the Messi effect in 2024?
I think it will be really interesting because everyone wants their piece of Messi. And that's the biggest thing that I learned last year is that when they went on the road, I went to the game in Orlando in which he didn't play. And yes, you had this level of people through the door that wouldn't have been there if even the possibility of Messi playing was going to be there. So it raises that level of atmosphere. But there is that also level of, oh man, I really wanted to see the greatest player of all time play in this game. And you see it, you saw it some in the preseason tour. And for me, it'll be really interesting to see, first off, if Inter Miami prove themselves to be a juggernaut because they have Messi, kind of how much that raises the level of all the other players in the team, the young players in the team, and all of that. But I will find really interesting to see how much that has a reverberating effect on the rest of the league and the teams that beat Messi. How does that impact their beat Inter Miami? How does that affect their mentality, the way they kick on for the rest of the season? Is Inter Miami's visit to every stadium going to be that team's Super Bowl? Is every game that Inter Miami plays in CONCACAF Champions Cup and Leagues Cup going to be that team's Super Bowl because they have this player coming and playing against them, and wow, we get to play against the greatest player of all time? So in my view, it is just really fascinating to see where Miami prioritize in terms of the competitions that they want to win, how they rest him, and how they end up using this incredibly valuable resource. And I think you're already starting to see with some of the teams setting their transfer records and all that, teams want to compete. You don't want to just go into a game against Messi and exist and rake in the money from the tickets. You want to win. You want to beat this team because it would mean so much within your market. I remember when Chicago won, they obviously were in the midst of a playoff chase. They beat Inter Miami, and it was a really big deal that went off once they won that game. So I think that's the biggest thing is trying to maximize this effect, but also how the realities of the human body and the 36-year-old human body are going to play out when he's going to miss games. He might get injured here and there. Like that's going to be a reality and what happens at that point.
You live in South Florida. Does the English language media pay as much attention every day to Messi as the Spanish language media?
No. And I would actually say probably the international, particularly obviously the Argentinian, but definitely the international media might even pay more attention than the local media. And I don't want to say that necessarily as a criticism. I do think, you know, when training camp, as it were, opened, when training started opening, preseason training, a lot of the TV stations went out. It's also been a very good year in Miami sports. The Dolphins had a great season, and the Heat went to the finals, and the Panthers went to the Stanley Cup final. But that month of Leagues Cup, every day, every local station was out there, and they realized the mania that had swept this area, and you still see the jerseys everywhere and all of that. I'll be curious what it'll look like this year, just because there was that flash in the pan moment, then the regular season kind of fizzled out, and then obviously without playoffs, they've been not playing competitive games for 4 months now. So what happens when they come back, and what happens, and again, it will come back to winning. If they win a lot, then they'll get that level of local coverage and it will be a mania yet again, but it will be hard to envisage, unless they go on a similar kind of run in Champions Cup or in another tournament, obviously in the playoffs, just that mania, that fever, that every game was a big deal. It dominated the headlines for a month. Every game was interesting. Every game, Messi did something amazing. The team did something amazing. There were great games. There were penalty shootouts. You couldn't script a more entertaining way for something like this to begin, with the celebrities, with all this crazy culture around it. And so the fact that we got to that stage so quickly, it will take some recreating. But yeah, I think that local interest will definitely remain, because this is the greatest player of all time and he plays in our backyard every 2 weeks. It's insane.
You have put your anchor in the soccer water. And so what are the greatest joys of what you're doing?
For me, it's calling games. It will always be calling games. I just, there is that feeling, especially now getting to work on Serie A with Matteo Bonetti, who's a fantastic partner, and with the CBS team, they're amazing. And then when you look at getting to call the Derby della Madonnina, the Derby d'Italia, all these massive games, when I sit there and I'm looking at my screen, because obviously I'm not there, I just have this enormous sense of, like, this is incredible. This is, like, what I want to be doing. I remind myself, like, 30 minutes before kickoff, this is what you want to be doing. Smile and enjoy it. Not, like, in a forceful way, but, like, let's take this in for a second. And like I said, I love traveling the country and seeing what MLS is in all these different cities. And I just love taking in these big occasions and working on these big events. It will always get me out of bed in the morning. And I've got a few coming up, which will be revealed in due course. But even MLS, like the start, like I had my first MLS game in a week and a half, and I cannot wait to go to Philadelphia. And it'll be great. And I cannot wait for these things. And it's what animates me. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning. It's why I love doing this. And I just love calling a big game. I love feeling atmosphere. I love going to a stadium. I love the travel. I traveled way more last year than I ever have in my entire life. I probably got on 55 round trips last year. It was insane, but I loved it. So yeah, you get to absorb so much as a result of working in this game. And for me, the games make everything worthwhile.
In turn, what are the greatest challenges that you face doing this?
I traveled 55 times round trip last year. It's funny. It's the same thing, but turned on its head. Right. Yeah. I mean, the level of travel, never really feeling like you're at home that much. Last year was just a general year of a lot of turbulence, just a lot of things that were different. Right. And it took some getting used to, and there were definitely some times where I would push it. There was one week in particular where I did an MLS game on a Saturday, an MLS game on a Wednesday, got on a flight on Thursday morning to do two shows with the Golasso Network on a Thursday and Friday, and then flew from the Golasso Network, which is based in Connecticut, all the way out to Seattle, and I called a game in Seattle, and then I flew home 6.5 hours the next morning. My flight was at 7 a.m. or whatever. And I remember at the end of that going, what are you doing? Like, slow down. This is crazy. And the reason why you say yes to all those things is because they are fun in and of themselves. But also realizing, and I think people talk about mental health a lot in terms of struggle or in terms of, you know, fighting demons. But I think a lot of this stuff is also just based off of your life battery. And I had to realize that I had to recharge my life battery sometimes. That just to go from empty to 50% to empty to 75%. No, you have to recharge the battery and take time off and spend days not thinking about soccer. And I know, and it's weird because it's the thing that you like. It's the thing that you enjoy the most. But spend a day watching shows. Spend a day going outside and taking in what else there is in this world. But there are days where you just get so absorbed with it. And there are so many leagues. And there's always a game on. And a game that you want to watch because it's fun and it's interesting. But I just learned that I had to recharge my battery. And I've been pushing for a long time, years, and just in terms of I'll take a gig anywhere. Like I'm working here, but you know, if I can squeeze it in on a Saturday night, I'm in. And I haven't had Saturday nights to myself in a very long time. And so I think kind of realizing that, and again, this is not to complain, it's just to realize like how important it is to protect yourself. Because it's not just that you're, you know, protecting yourself, you're making yourself feel better, you're also protecting the quality of your work. Because if you're not at 100% when you show up to a stadium, you show up to call a game, and you show up to do a show in the studio, you're not going to deliver your best work. And so it's the biggest thing for me that I realized in the last year was take time off, and it's okay to be off. It's okay to, all right, well, there's a, you know, Bundesliga game on a Tuesday at 2:45 that you could put on, but it's probably better for your health if you don't. And that's the biggest thing that I probably learned in the last year was you have to recharge your battery. And that's in a variety of ways. That's, you know, getting outside, that's exercising, that's, you know, turning off the game, that's watching something stupid on TV. It's doing a variety, having friend groups and going to trivia nights and things like that, that I've kind of realized in the last year are just as important as putting in the work into your job.
Chris Whittingham quickly working his way up the ladder in American soccer broadcasting. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media.